Coming to you from Silicon Valley, I'm Marcus Edwards, and I'm on the hunt for recruiting leaders, producers, innovators, and pioneers who've made their mark on the industry and can't wait to share their points of view. We'll tackle the tough topics and dig deep to find the answers you're looking for and some actionable advice you can take to the bank. So stick around and stay tuned, and welcome to Recruiting Trailblazers. Very excited today about my guest on Recruiting Trailblazers. Mike Batman Cohen is the founder of Wayne Technologies and well-known in the sourcing and recruiting community as an advocate and practitioner of technology automation and innovation in our industry. He's spoken at many conferences such as SourceCon, Talent 42, Sourcing Summit, HR Now, RecruitCon, and many more. And also, he's a fellow cycling instructor. He's in seminary part-time. He's got 16 nephews and nieces. And apparently he uses more recruiting tools than any other organization on the planet. Welcome to Recruiting Trailblazers, Mike Batman Cohen.
Marcus, that was awesome, man. I'm going to have to like get you recorded doing that so I can intro myself that way every time. That is awesome. Thanks, man.
You're welcome, mate. I literally wrote that this morning in 5 minutes just from the notes from our previous conversation. So thanks.
It's amazing how bad some people, raising my hand now, are at introing themselves and selling themselves. But man, you've got a knack for that. That's great. I'm doing well, man. I'm excited about this podcast. And I've done a few. I think one of the cool things is that you and I connected for like an hour before this and didn't get into the like, so what do you want to talk about? What do you want to like? We talked about cycling for like 20 minutes. It was awesome. So I'm really excited to see what your podcast brings, folks.
Yeah, no, it's great. I love talking about indoor cycling because it's one of my biggest passions in life. So I know you're still teaching, right? I'm not teaching at the moment because they've closed my gym, the health club that I work at, but I'll be back at it as soon as I possibly can.
I am. Yes.
So let's get into it. Mike, why are you called Batman and how did Wayne Technologies come about?
Yeah. The short answer is because I gave myself the nickname, which is unfortunately completely true. So
you can't fly off buildings and, you haven't got a batarang.
I'm going to plead the fifth. So I do have a batarang actually.
Yeah.
It was about 4.5 years ago, when Trump was running for president, I was looking to brand myself, as opposed to my company. And I was looking at like my name, Michael Cohen, two very, very common names. So I'm trying to figure out where's my branding. Do I do like MC or whatever? Right around the time Trump's lawyer started doing some interviews, and he was objectively, it's the right way to say this, rough around the edges publicly. And he did some interviews that were funny as an outsider, but like not super nice as a human. Right. And I realized, his name's Michael Cohen. I'm never appearing on Google again. And so I never read comics as a kid. I read my first one when I was 19. It was obviously a Batman comic. And I fell in love with the psychology behind the character, and everything he stood for. He's also, he came about being the world's greatest detective. He gave DC Comics their namesake, Detective Comics. And so I thought, you know what? Let's see how this works, right? I'm reaching out to software engineers, right? Yeah. Like I'm a member of geek culture. Let's see how this works out. And it stuck.
It's a great idea and it's great to brand yourself. And I think Batman actually interviewed a lot of people before he ultimately recruited Robin. So you could call him a recruiter as well.
There's some validity there. He also may or may not screen potential villains.
Yeah.
Maybe they're hanging off of buildings upside down, but like it's still a screening, you know?
Yeah, we could push this one.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, I'm going to stop now. So Wayne Tech was... is my company. I'd formed about 3 years ago. I've been agency side my whole life. And, you know, admittedly, and I'm not shy about this, I was one of those crappy agency side recruiters who just like threw crap against the wall and was all about the numbers and smile and dial 100 calls a day, right? One of those types.
Well, that's an interesting point that you're making there, because I don't think that makes you a crappy agency recruiter. I think the industry has been growing up for a very long time. And I think, you know, when I started, and I'm probably a few years older than you, It was all about how many calls you had to make. It was all about metrics. And to a certain extent, it still is. You're absolutely right. Calls, probably less so. Calendar invites, maybe. But definitely resumes out the door, interviews on the interview sheet. So I think you were probably just doing what you were told to do, right?
So yes and no. So yes, I completely agree. That was the time, right? LinkedIn had just come out around that time. And it was, so yes, my perception of that today is of subpar recruitment, if that's what you're focused on. Not you, generally. Yep. Humans, because we can be better than that. Keep in mind for anybody listening, if you've watched any of my stuff or you've seen me and are wondering like, oh my gosh, you know, he's got, you know, 14 years almost of experience. No wonder why he's got this Boolean and messaging type of focus or expertise. I've been doing this for less than 3 years.
Right.
So like you're less than 3 years away from doing this. You're probably as smart as I am. So you can probably do this as well, smarter. So,
well, let's break this down for a minute.
Talk to me.
Let's talk about the basics. You've been doing what for 3 years? You're an agency recruiter. You're throwing mud against walls. You begin to realize that there's a better way to do this. And that, in fact, there are a lot of tools being developed now and available to us that are going to help us be a lot better at doing this. Talk to me through that epiphany. And what are some of the things and the best practices that you started to implement that really changed you as a recruiter?
Yeah. So in full disclosure, my wife hates that I share this, but I think it's real and I think it gives people perspective. So I've been let go from every agency I've ever worked at. I'm not proud of that. It's definitely embarrassing. It hurts to say out loud. But the truth is, I was not a fit working for people doing things because that's the way you do things. So that bothered me. So I started my own company with the intent of like, I'm going to do things my way and it's going to be awesome. And for the first year I was legitimately like, I think most people are when trying new things or going out on their own, I was too scared, right? I had all these stories I was telling myself about like, well, how are you going to provide for your family? Mm-hmm. Right? Like what happens if you fail? So I spent the first year.
Imposter syndrome. We've all got it. Don't worry.
Oh yeah. But at that point I actually didn't have any of these skills I had. So it was legit. It was just me syndrome.
And how did that manifest itself in terms of the way you did the job initially?
So for the first year, I just consulted to other recruiting agencies, helping them kind of build up their processes. And it led to me not doing as great a job as I would have wanted at that time because I didn't know who I was. I just started going through my own personal self-actualization process around that time. And so it took like a year, literally a straight year. We had a parting of ways with my second contract and had a couple of difficult conversations with people I highly respect in my life about like, hey, why don't you go do that thing that you said you were going to do and actually step out on your own, right? And like all the fear around family and providing is totally unfounded. If you don't know, I'm married to an amazing, beautiful, wildly intelligent and successful woman who is a principal at Mercer HR. Mm-hmm. And we don't have kids. So like that was more ego probably than like how we're going to keep a roof over our head. Like my wife's made more money than me our entire career. Like this is no different. So I finally took the step out in 2018, about September, and said, you know what? I'm going to do this on my own. And I started doing contingency recruiting. One of my first clients was Giphy and Eric Goldfarb over there runs the recruiting. He's a great guy. And as I was doing it, I realized, no, this still sucks. Contingency recruiting still sucks. Like, I just don't like it. It's a grind. You know, you can do everything perfectly and not make any money.
And not make a placement. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a fan of contingency recruitment anymore. I did it for many years. And to be honest with you, I run a small search firm called Verana Group. And we only work exclusively retained or contained.
Yeah, we work fundamentally the same. We don't focus on retained. We focus more on our sourcing or sprint model.
Right. So Wayne Technologies is actually focused on top of the funnel sourcing as opposed to the full recruiting lifecycle, right?
Yeah. So this developed actually over that next, we'll call it like 5 months. I spoke at my first conference, recruiting conference ever in 2018. It was ERE. Todd Raphael, who I think is with Eightfold now, gave me a shot. He was amazing. And then Craig Fisher, who has TalentNet, did the same thing. And so I spoke at my first conference in 2018, and I wound up meeting some great folks. Nin Tran over at HireTool gave me a heck of a chance and said, you know, we'd love to have you as like an evangelist. Why don't you try using our tool and, you know, see what you think. Give us some feedback. And that snowballed into meeting other folks at different companies. You know, Jeremy Roberts, who's now at Seek Out, but he was at Hiring Solved at the time. And I wound up reaching out because I wanted to like figure out, hey, how do I get better at this? And so I'm like, okay, I'm friends with Aaron Daniels down here. He goes, dude, here's like five people you should reach out to him.
What was your first talk about at ERE? What did you speak about?
Vulnerability.
Oh, really?
this is great. So I reached out to Todd and I was like, hey man, I'd like to speak at your conference. He was like, okay, do you have any like videos? If you do, I'm like, no, I've never spoken to one. He's like, okay, what would you want to speak about? I was literally reading, again, going through this self-actualization process. I was reading Brené Brown's The Power of Vulnerability. And I was like, you know, it'd be a great talk is to hear somebody talk about like what it looks like to be vulnerable, but professionally, like not only as a person, but also as an organization and how that would affect recruitment. And he goes, yeah, that's awesome. All right, great. Let's do that. And like got off the phone and I was like, oh shit, that's me. I'm giving that talk. I was like, that is not what I meant. I thought it'd be cool, like Brené Brown doing this talk, you know? So that's how I got into that talk and wound up, you know, again, spiraling down or spiraling up, I guess, meeting all these folks at different companies who gave me access to their tooling with the return expectation of very direct feedback, as well as creating a business use case around each one. So long story short, 2019 is one of my favorite years I've ever had. Definitely my favorite professionally. I spoke at 19 conferences or something. I did somewhere around that number of webinars and podcasts also. And like, I loved it. I wound up meeting just insanely amazing people and growing my network for me to literally grow as a human throughout the process. It was during that time I met Jer Langens at Paired Sourcing, who had reached out and said like, hey, we could use some help. You want to like do some work with us? I was like, yeah, sure. And they got me interested in this like deliverables based model, where it was all top of funnel. And as a shout out, you know, Jer is still doing that with Paired Sourcing. So if that's something you're looking at, I do that and Jer does that. We do it differently. So reach out to either of us. He's a great guy.
So talk to me. Top of the funnel sourcing is basically the service that you're describing is as opposed to actually placing a candidate and, uh-huh. and charging a fee based on that person's annual salary. You are basically just responsible for sourcing candidates who are interested in having a conversation and then presenting them to the client and then you walk away.
Yes, at a high level, yes. You know the bottom line, Marcus, I do not like being responsible for things that are outside of my control. I'm a control freak. I have OCD tendencies in particular areas of my life. And I just don't like the idea that I can't control my own success. And so I started analyzing, what does a recruiter do? Right. And I, you know, you ask 100 people, you'll get 90 different answers. But most of them boil down to like, we make placements, we make hires, we get candidates jobs, we fill company openings, blah, 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 blah. And with nothing but respect, no, you don't. That's not what a recruiter does. Right. So when I ask recruiters, I'm like, hey, how many hires do you have this year? Like, 13. I'm like, oh, really? You've hired 13 people? Well, No. I mean, the hiring managers hired 13 people. I'm like, yes.
You've introduced 13 successful candidates.
Yes, yeah. Marcus, exactly. Right. So I started looking at that and realizing like, if you were making the hires, you'd be called a hiring recruiter, but you're not. It's a hiring manager. So what is the actual job of a recruiter? The actual job of a recruiter, when you break it down to its essence, is we are a bi-directional data pipeline. That's it. We take data from an organization and bring it to market. we take data from the market and bring it to the organization to allow both parties to make the best informed decision for them. That's it. And you can look at like, well, we have phone screens. I'm like, yeah, that's gathering data. That's what you're doing. You're gathering data so that you can bring that data back to the company, which is the hiring manager, right? We post job descriptions. Yeah, that's bringing the data of the company to the market, right? No matter how you look at it.
And so what did you do with this realization?
The first thing I did was finished my wife's closet, which is another story for another time. The second thing I did was look at, okay, what are the pieces I have total control over? I have total control over the sourcing, and I have more or less total control over the messaging. I can't make people respond, but I can, through my own betterment and efficiency, get percentages, right? So like we share, like we guarantee a 25% response rate on our messaging.
But you don't sell the service so much as the deliverable, am I right?
Exactly correct. The service piece of it is the messaging.
Yeah.
So we do, we try to get an email address on our client's domain. So that way it's branded for them. It doesn't look like a third party agency is sending messaging. Not possible for everybody, which is fine. We draft up all the messaging unique for each role, unique for each client, and send out the messaging campaigns. And as people write back, if they're not interested, we mark why. If they are interested, we make an intro to the internal point of contact at the client.
Okay, let's dig in here for a minute, because this is a recruiting podcast, and hopefully there's a ton of recruiters, thousands of recruiters listening to us today. So
millions.
Messaging best practices. Okay, you're talking about per role, you're writing different messages and creating different messages. So to a certain extent, I'm going to guess that there's a level of automation here involved.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been a big fan, and we touched on this before, I'm a huge fan of personalization in messages.
Yep.
And obviously that is possible if you segment certain audiences and you can sort of speak almost specifically to them, but it's not possible to send a unique message to every single person if you're using an automation tool. So talk to me about your messaging best practices. What works for you? What are the things that you have begun to realize are the best ways to reach out to people in 2020?
Yeah, that's loaded and awesome. So to touch on that, there's two different approaches, I believe, in this space, which are snipers and talent mappers. Snipers want to send 8 messages, get 7 of them to respond, screen 3 of them. Talent mappers want a more holistic view of the market and don't mind messaging 100 to 200 people to get, 40 to respond, to then set up, 5 to 10 screens. There's a time and a place for each of those. None of those are correct.
Is there another way?
Oh, yeah. You can be just total shit and email everybody. That's another way. Yeah, for sure. And people are going to say like, well, what about cold calling? And I'm going to say, cool, as long as the people you're looking for are Gen X and above. I'm a millennial, and I can tell you I despise getting cold calls. Despise. I'm still polite on the phone, but it is a very quick brush off to shoot me an email to set up a call.
And do you think you speak for your generation?
Because
I'm not quite a millennial.
I don't want to speak for my whole generation. I'm not comfortable doing that.
No.
Okay. But like, I would wager a large sum of money that more than 50% of my generation feels that way.
Yeah. It's funny because I actually like getting cold calls because I just appreciate the bravery and the fortitude of people who are doing it, especially if it's done well. I recently got a cold call from a company called Loxo, the ATS company.
Love Matt Chambers and everything they're doing.
Yeah, I don't know Matt, but I was so impressed by this person cold calling me at 9 a.m. on a Monday morning that I sent her a message and said, thank you for your, extremely professional cold call. And I also sent a message to Matt Chambers and just said, I just wanted to tell you what a great employee you have. And they sent me a t-shirt.
I love that. Their t-shirts are also super soft.
Great t-shirts. Loxo t-shirts are the best.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about personalization then for a second, because as a fan of personalization, you're saying automation does work, but there's a lot of noise out there today, isn't there? So what do you have to do within your message in order to distinguish yourself from just the template messages who are just sending out really boring templates that are not going to get any responses? What do you do slightly differently that allows you to get this high level of response?
Yeah. So when people ask, like, what is the one thing if I could change, you know, that would help me get better responses? I'm like, stop writing.
Hey, that was my next question.
Yes. Stop writing shitty emails. That's the one thing. How do you stop writing shitty emails? Read your email back to yourself and not like in your head. Say it out loud and not like when you're reading it like this and you're going through and reading the email.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually say it out loud. And if you sound like a goober or some weird professional version of yourself, or you're stumbling over your words, delete it and start over. Emails should read, if you are messaging to particularly millennials and Gen Z, should read like text messages.
Right. Good tip.
No one wants that three screen long text message from their parents. Right.
No one wants three long paragraphs describing this huge value proposition and this incredible opportunity. And
yeah,
no, you're absolutely right.
No one wants one paragraph, right? I see more than two or three sentences grouped together in one block and I'm done.
Right.
Like my brain can't handle that. So what are the keys? Focus on your subject line first. I will tell you, we've been A/B testing this for years, not joking, 3 years. Consistently, again, I don't make sweeping generalizations. It's not every time. This is based on our numbers, like 80% of the time. The best subject line is the candidate's company name. Mm-hmm. So if I'm reaching out to somebody who works at Lockheed Martin Missile Defense Group and they are, you know, a senior recruiter, when I email them, my subject line is Lockheed.
That's interesting, because I recently read or downloaded a PDF from somebody who's a messaging expert who said the highest performing subject line they've ever used is almost exactly what you just said. It's question about company that they're at. That's it. Question about Lockheed.
So
question mark. And that's it. And apparently that gets because remember that a subject line is there to get you to read the email. Nothing more, nothing less.
That's it. Just open the email. Yeah. And to take that one step further, the only reason to write an email is to get a response.
Yeah.
So if I know sending you a picture of a cat eating popcorn on a skateboard is going to get you to respond to me, that's what you're getting. It's going to be a cat eating popcorn on a skateboard. So really, really important. I want to touch on this because you brought this up just now. And I'm not doubting the source or the data, obviously, because it's in line with what I'm saying. Guys, if you Google like best subject lines or best, you're going to have 1,000 people telling you 1,000 different things. Here's the deal. Get the data. Where are they pulling that from? Right. There's two types of data they can pull from: historical and research. If it's research, show me what you were researching. Right. If it's historical, show me your historical data. Show me your screenshots. Don't just tell me, because I can tell you anything that sounds awesome. Right. And one of the things I do when I present about this is I share a combination of like 10 or 11 scientific journal articles that I actually downloaded and paid for that were like psychology researchers who were researching email best practices. And then I gave screenshots of my best and worst performing messaging. So that way it's not all like I picked, you know, my 10 best messages and like, here's the best practices. Like, that's crap.
Yeah, you're right. Because a lot of those articles are just clickbait. So you go back and join their email list and you download the PDF. And most of it's just anecdotal and it's not data driven at all, is it?
Yeah. Because when I ask like, hey, can you show me the data? It's like, oh, well, I've sent out 3 campaigns. It's like, cool. To how many people? There were like 10 or 12 on each one. I'm like, so you're telling people this is the best subject line based on emailing a total of 36 people?
So you're like Jerry Maguire banging his fists on the desk going, yeah, show me the data. Yeah.
Yes, that is 100% correct. So so the personalization on the subject line, that's my hot tip for everybody. In the email itself, write like you speak. Be short. Your emails should not be long. Mm-hmm. And be mindful of the personality type of the people you're reaching out to.
How do you do that from their LinkedIn profile?
I don't, because I do automation. So if you are a sniper, look at the profile and try to ascertain what personality type there are. I give a whole training around this, actually. I use the DISC assessment model, and I can relatively successfully guess someone's leading characteristic type from looking at their profile and or their Facebook page.
Right. So the sniper approach is obviously the personal approach. And the other approach, which is sort of send out 100 emails and automate it, it's harder to disguise the fact that it is a template. Do you do anything to disguise the fact that it's a template, or you just send it out and hope for the best?
Oh, ours definitely does not come across as a template. Our unsubscribe rate is much, much lower than people think. And again, I show screenshots of this in the presentation, right? I'm like, hey, New York Times, we shot out, you know, I don't know what it was at the time I shared. It was like 3,800 candidates were receiving messages from us, up to 5 messages at a time. And I asked everybody, I'm like, how many people out of that 3,800 do you think clicked unsubscribe or said stop messaging me? And the answer is exactly 10.
It's not bad.
Total. Right. And so yes, I think this works. What do we do? So we use modifiers, right? First name, company name. As a caveat to this, if you're using modifiers, clean up your data. Do not message me and say, hey, Mike Batman, how are things going? I delete that. It's obviously a spam templated message. No one calls me Mike Batman. It's one or the other.
It's just Batman.
Yeah. I mean, in an ideal world, I'm trying to get my wife there. And then don't ask me, how are things going at Wayne Technologies, Inc.? Deleted. That's a spam message. Clean your data up. Stop being lazy. Right. So I am Batman. Hey, Batman, how are things going at Wayne Tech, or how are things going at Wayne Technologies? Clean up your data.
And so these are all email addresses that you've sort of pre-harvested, or people who've opted in, or and they're all in some sort of email automation software?
Yeah, we've been using Lemlist more. The two that we gravitate towards are Lemlist and Interstellar. Interstellar is a little bit of a faster, kind of can crank through stuff a little bit quicker than Lemlist can. Lemlist has image modifiers, which is the next big thing I was going to get to. So communicate in your own voice. Clean up your data, use humor, super important, right? And if you're like, well, I don't know, I'm reaching out to CFOs, like, okay, cool. If you've ever met a CFO, probably ask them, hey, CFO, think of the last time somebody told you a genuinely funny joke or you read something really funny, okay? Did you enjoy that? That's a dumb question. Of course they enjoy that. Everybody likes funny things. It's that's a commonality in our species. Humor is enjoyable. And so use humor. It's okay. If you still are on the fence about it, message me. I'll send you the 2 scientific journal articles that tell you use humor. And so how do we do that? Typically in our 3rd or 4th email, depending on the type of role we're working, we do switch it up. We include a meme in every single sequence. CFO at a biopharma company, they got a meme. VP of research at...
What, cats on skateboards?
No. Super customized per role. So like we create all of our own memes. So we find images online, find funny things or funny jokes about, you know, the role or the industry or whatever, and then create a meme around it that's specific to that position.
Right.
And what Lemlist allows us to do, which is why we love it, is put in modifiers into the image text. So we can actually say in a meme, first name, you know, doing blah, 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 you know, first name doing blah, 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 right? Whatever that is, right?
Yeah, that is so cool. I watched a YouTube video on Lemlist's capabilities, yes, and it's ridiculous. So it looks like it is custom made for you. It's brilliant.
Exactly. And that's the whole deal, right? Is when someone reads that, no one's going to read an email where the very first thing is this ideally funny meme that has their name in it and say, spam. Like, come on.
You've upped your chances at that point for attracting their attention and getting them to read the next sentence.
Big time. And it's normally a joke is the next sentence. It's like we try to be funny because, you know, we're pretty funny here. And then the 5th email. So the first 4 that we send, one email is written in a way to appeal to each personality profile. So you ask, well, how do you know which one it is? We don't, and we don't care. Why don't we care? Because our first email is written that if you're a high D on the DISC personality profile, the way the content is laid out and written, like the verbiage, is going to appeal to you. Yeah. The second email is written for a high S, same idea. Then typically a high C, unless we're looking at finance and accountants, then we switch it and the meme goes here. Then the high I, the people is the fourth email.
So you've taken the four quadrants of the DISC assessment and you've said, if we send four emails to everybody, at least one of them is going to appeal to each one of these people, considering those four personality traits.
Bingo.
Yeah.
And
see, look at me. I'm a quick study.
Yeah, dude, I'm loving it. the fifth email, not joking at all, is a picture of my dogs.
Is a picture of your dogs?
Yeah, not joking. I have two, like, they're objectively super freaking cute dogs. And yeah, it's literally a picture of my dogs. I make a joke about them being nefarious. And in the image, they are just like smiling, adorable, like puppy faces. And then I'm like, just kidding. Those really are my dogs, though.
Yeah. Hey, at this point in the podcast,
yeah,
if someone's thinking, God, this sounds really amazing, how do I do this? Do you have any examples that you'd be willing to share if someone were to connect with you on LinkedIn or send you an email? Yeah.
I am wildly open source.
Excellent.
You want a template? I will send you a document that literally has messaging I wrote, like, I don't know, a month ago.
Great. So anybody who's interested can just connect with you at Mike Batman Cohen at Wayne Technologies, and you'll send them a couple of examples or some advice on how they can get on board with this sort of lemlist approach. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll literally send them the templates, the exact messaging I write.
That's called a value bomb right there. I just introduced a value bomb to my podcast. Well done, Mike. Thanks.
Yeah, no problem, man.
Yeah. What about video? Because I've started receiving only just recently a few videos from people who have recorded a sniper approach video to me. And I'm a sucker for them. I can't resist it. I'm like, well, if you've taken the time to do a 30-second video for me, then I'm going to respond. And so I do respond and I say, sure, I'll have a quick call with you. What do you think of them?
I am 100% in that boat. I literally took a call with somebody who is selling a service I had zero interest in at all.
Right.
Solely because he shot me a LinkedIn message. It was his third message. So, like, yay, persistence. His other two messages were like, meh. But his third message is a video of him saying, hey, Mike, I'm writing you a message. I looked up Wayne Technologies. I know you guys do sourcing and recruiting training. I think based on that, blah, 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 would at least be interesting to chat with you about. I'd love to connect with you. And I was like,
right.
Shit. All right, fine. Here's my calendar link. I'm like, because that tells me you took the time, you did your research, and there is a specific reason you're reaching out to me. It's not because the word Java is on my profile.
Right. For the most part, nobody's really doing it yet. I've only just started to receive a couple of them. And so I think there's a window of opportunity there.
Somebody really good to talk to about this is Adrian Kulf.
Yep.
With Matcher.
He was on the podcast.
Yeah, he is. This is like one of his jams, and he is real, real good at this.
Okay, well, here is value bomb number two. Adrian was a keynote speaker at SourceCon, and he did a presentation on video outreach, and he shows in this video how not to do it and how he failed and then what he changed in order to become successful at video outreach. And it's an excellent video. It's about 30 or 40 minutes long, but it is well worth watching. If you're interested, send me an email, connect with me on LinkedIn, and I'll send you the link.
Yep. Yep. I also have that recording from the one you did at SoSu.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was just, it's good.
That's pretty. So where do you get, how have you built your database? I mean, where do you get all these email addresses? Do you scrape LinkedIn? Do you use automation tools like Phantom Buster to scrape LinkedIn for email addresses?
I would obviously never scrape LinkedIn because that is against terms of service, but I would, automated acquire data from LinkedIn in a fashion that may resemble that. I use a bunch of email finding tools.
Yeah.
We have like 13.
Yeah. Do you still try and connect with tons of people on a daily or weekly basis? I mean, LinkedIn seemed to have loosened up a bit now. And if you're a premium customer, they don't mind if you send out 50 connection requests a day. So why doesn't everybody just do it?
I'm sending out like 200 roughly. So I use, you ever hear My Robot Works?
I haven't actually, no.
This guy, Ivan, and I'm going to butcher his last name. Sorry, Ivan. Stojanovic. He's in Ireland and he created a company called My Robot Works, and it actually automates this process.
But yeah, I think you have to be careful because, as you say, LinkedIn do not want you automating within their platform. So you have to be careful.
They're doing anything because they're the blue devil.
Yeah, you have to be careful what you do. And if you do decide to do it, you start small. Just start with 5 or 10 a day. And then you just start to build so that you don't cause any or trigger any sort of sequences at their end.
Has to be a delay between every single profile. And there should be, the thing I love about My Robot Works is I have it as a 30-second delay between profiles, and they automatically range it between like 25 and 35 seconds. So it's not the same exact delay. And then every, like I set it every 6 profiles, I want you to delay for 3 minutes.
Yep. That's very, very clever. Because then it actually looks like it's coming from you. And the other one as well that do this is Duck Soup. Have you heard of those guys?
I have heard of Duck Soup, yeah.
Okay. And I don't know anything about them, but I've heard they're quite good. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty interesting. There is no silver bullet, okay? There's no silver bullet to this. You have to, even using this Lemlist approach, it's quite complex. You've got to get your head around the methodology and then the way that you do it and the way that you segment your audience, and you've still got to do everything you can to at least make it look, check your data to make sure that you're speaking specifically to your previous example, to the individual that you are emailing, and give yourself the best chance of initiating that first conversation, because that's what it's all about, right?
That's right.
Yeah. You sequence your follow-ups, so you do 5 or 6 follow-ups. Where are you finding?
I do 5.
Okay. At what point during the process, email 2, 3, 4, 5, are you getting the best results?
Depends on who we're reaching out to. So reaching out to accounting and finance professionals, it's usually whichever email is the one written for high C types. They like just short, sweet, give me the data and get out. If we're reaching out to marketing folks, it's almost always the high I, the meme and the creativity. Executives, it's always going to be the high D, almost always the dominant personality style.
Yeah. And just sort of finishing up this messaging piece in our conversation. I mean, it is literally the most important part of the process that we are both involved in, which is attracting people's attention and asking them for that initial conversation. You've talked about cats and skateboards and humor, and are there any sort of phrases or anecdotes that you can share with us that really work and resonate with people? Are there any particular word tracks or anything that you use that are very successful when you do these outreaches?
Yeah. So yes, there is. And you'd mentioned earlier, there's no silver bullet. I don't agree with that. I think there is a silver bullet tool in our industry.
Thank goodness.
That if you're using, you will always achieve success.
Okay. Drum roll, please.
It's your personality.
My personality or everyone's?
Anyone's personality. That's a silver bullet. Why? Because you work for a company who hired you as a person, which means that in some way or another, minus extenuating circumstances, you represent that company's brand and what they stand for and the culture, which means that your personality should be in alignment with the people that you're talking to in some way. It's also the most genuine and authentic thing that you can portray, in which case the more of your personality and humanness that you can put into all of your contact, communication, your outreach, your social presence, your literally everything, the more success you'll see every time. You do not have to win every battle.
How do you do that, though, in one of these very short emails that you've described?
I write the exact same way I would say it. It's just me, right? I'm just like, all right, cool. How would I say, hey, hope I'm not breaking up your flow at company. Oh, I know. I'd go, hey, I hope I'm not breaking up your flow at company. And I type it, right? And then I would say, if I were thinking, I'd be like, TLDR, right? Too long, didn't read. XYZ company is hiring for XYZ role for this reason. Here are the reasons it may be an interesting fit for you. Done. Right. That's just how I would say it. So when people are like, well, what's the best way to say this? I'm like, I don't know. How would you say it? That's going to be the best way because it's genuine.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with that. It's something that I've been working on myself. And we did have a really good podcast a few weeks ago with Henna Pryor, who specializes in messaging and outreach. And we talked a bit about this as well. She's exceptionally good at this as well. So, brilliant stuff. We could go on and on about this messaging piece. It's something that is so important. I think we've got time. in the pre-conversation, you talked to me a little bit about addiction in the TA space. And so this is a little bit of a tangential topic here, but I wanted to just open you up a little bit on addiction and how it's impacted you previously and how you see it manifesting itself in the industry that we're in and what we can do about it. So take the floor and give us a quick rundown, please, Mike.
I myself, as a human outside of recruitment, I suffer from addiction. It's something I've been in the 12-step program for, I don't know, 3.5, almost 4 years now. And is something that brought me to just a rough point in life, right? Hit the proverbial rock bottom. And by the blessing of that program, a really good therapist and a wife who is just, God, angelically graceful would be the best way I could put it, and patient and loving and kind, I was able to start kind of self-actualizing, right? And that's the whole purpose of a 12-step program, if you're not familiar. It's not this hunky-dory, everybody hold hands and everything will be okay. It's very much about looking inside and figuring out, like, where's your shit?
Right. So it's the process of looking in the mirror and being honest with yourself about who you are.
Bingo. And so as I'm going through this process myself personally, I'm recognizing that a lot of it's bleeding over professionally. And I'm starting to subconsciously, I'm not thinking this, but as I'm getting my own life together and going through this recovery program and getting the support of my sponsor, my therapist, my wife, other group members, right? I'm realizing that I'm actually doing the same thing in parallel professionally, right? I still have the support of my wife. She's the one constant in my entire life, my rock.
When you say you're doing the same thing, you're exhibiting addictive type behaviors?
No, other way around. I'm identifying them and realizing, why am I doing this?
Such as?
The common ones, LinkedIn. Why am I so addicted to LinkedIn? Like, what would I do if LinkedIn shut down for 3 days? Would I just not recruit for 3 days? Like, what does that look like? And like, the answer to that 4 years ago was, yeah, I don't know what I'd do. So it was identifying that. It was identifying an addiction to my cell phone, right? Like, I would lay down in my bed at night and spend an hour on my phone, which for so many reasons is bad, right? The first thing I would do in the morning is roll over and check my phone.
Most people do that today, especially here in 2020 when there's not much else to do except look at your phone.
Oh my God, 2020 is a rare exception for a bunch of this weird stuff. But social media was the other big one. So I actually deleted my Facebook account. Not deactivated, deleted. I had it since 2004, maybe? My freshman year in college.
Yeah.
And just deleted. Done. Why? Because I was putting too much emphasis on the successful or social acceptance of my posting. And
I actually did have a Facebook account, but I deleted it as well a long time ago. And I think the addiction there is the addiction. Honestly, it's the addiction to being liked, to getting those likes.
100%.
It's getting that constant reminder, that constant sort of dopamine hit that somebody likes your stuff. That's the addiction, isn't it?
Yeah. And it becomes the addiction. So addiction is an actual chemical thing. It's not like this woo woo, why don't you just put it down and stop doing it? It's not the chemical hooks. It's actually the mental, like biophysical, or biochemical reactions in your brain, like you were describing, with like dopamine and dopamine uptake and intake. And so what's happened is, in a lot of ways, to your social example, the social networks, when you walk down the street and like somebody stops you and goes, hey, that is a really sharp suit, or like, wow, that's a really pretty dress, or your hair looks really nice. You naturally, in your brain releases dopamine. It feels nice. You get that warm feeling. It's like, oh my gosh, thank you so much. You naturally smile. It's a chemical reaction. It's not, you're not cognizant right. of it. That same thing now is happening when people like your photo. And it's happening to a similar level in terms of dopamine levels because of our reliance on the systems. And that is broken. And that is an addiction. So those are some of them. Obviously, there's the big addictions that everybody knows about, right? Alcohol, drugs, gambling, sex, food, etc. But it can be anything. Anything that you do to escape from any of those really strong or uncomfortable feelings or situations is an addiction. Doesn't matter what it is. It can be working out, it can be solving Rubik's Cubes, it can be playing with your dogs. If that's what you do.
Is working out an addiction, though? Because we're both spinning instructors, and I would argue that that would be the best addiction in the world to have, which is getting on a bike, in our case, a spin bike. It could be running, it could be swimming, it could be anything. And working so hard that your body becomes flooded with, I think it's serotonin or it's something, and it's called runner's high or rider's high, and it's an actual thing that I believe 100% in because it makes you feel amazing for the rest of the day, which is why I've always advocated for spinning first thing in the morning.
So everything you're saying is correct. That is not an addiction, at least for me. So when I'm feeling sad or angry or surprised or afraid, I don't think, you know what, I'm just going to go work out. I'm just going to go work out. That's not my thing. Right. For me, food is my number one. COVID's been rough. I'm glad we're not on camera. So what is the thing that instead of working through the emotions or the situation that you distract yourself with? It's called numbing out. Whatever that thing is the addiction. And I don't think actually you do that. You don't strike me as the type of person who, when like something really just like shitty happens or you're feeling really bad about something, that like, as opposed to saying like, okay, what's going on with me right now? Why am I feeling this way?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I'm not addicted to it in the way that it's a reaction to something negative happening. I don't immediately go and jump on my bike. I'm just sort of like aware of how good. Yeah. I'm aware of how good it makes me feel.
Yeah.
And on the days same. I don't do it, I sort of scratch my head and say, why am I not doing it? I don't feel nearly as good as on the days that I did do it.
Bingo.
So for the sake of the podcast, we've identified what addiction is and we're running pretty low on time here, but is there a cure for this? I mean, you've been through the 12-step program and thanks for sharing that with us. Is there a cure for these types of addictions? What should people be doing instead?
No, there's no cure. Nope. And that's true. There's not going to be a time where you just wake up and you're like, I don't suffer from any addictions anymore. It's never going to be the case. You will pendulum. Sometimes it'll be really hard and you'll be like, you know what? F it. I need this. Like, I get it. I shouldn't be doing this, but I'm doing it. Right. That time where like, you just have that like terrible day, just everything goes to shit and it's at night and you haven't eaten yet. And you're like, you know what? I'm having Ben & Jerry's.
No, I hear you.
Like, you know you shouldn't do that, right? So what do you do to overcome these different addictions, whether it's LinkedIn or striving for metrics? I'm not a metrics person in the way that most people think about it. I think people are addicted to metrics. What do you do? Well, follow the same thing you would do if you were an addict to, let's say, alcohol, right? You join a 12-step program. Well, what does that look like in our community? Join groups, right? Join a Facebook group and become involved. Reach out to other people. That's how I acquired this knowledge initially. I just reached out to people who I recognize as leaders in the space and said, hey, I'm trying to get better. Can we just connect? And that's it. And I just connected with a bunch of people. So number one, connect with people. Number two, get a therapist. A therapist in our world, first off, actually get a therapist because they're awesome. Second, in terms of like therapy, that would be like a career coach or a mentor. Get somebody who you can talk to and bounce ideas off of and kind of help you when you're thinking like, I'm going to do this thing. And they're like, whoa, don't do that thing, right? Get a career coach. Ask somebody who you want to aspire to be more like, and that you can feel accountable and responsible to and with.
Yeah, I think it's important to have people who are capable of being objective about your life because we look upon our lives very subjectively. And I've worked with lots of leaders, similarly to you, I've worked with a lot of leaders in the agency space and I've ended up being somewhat of a shrink to many of the people I've worked with because I have the ability, not because I'm brilliant, But I have the ability to share perspective or objectivity on their lives that they don't have. And I'm much better at helping other people solve their problems than I've ever been at solving my own, obviously. So I think having someone in your life that can offer you that objectivity is extremely important. And finding your group, finding your clan, so that you don't feel alone with any of these types of addictions that you possibly have. So that's probably a good way to wrap that bit up. Mike Batman Cohen, my favorite superhero, and now a very good friend. Yes. Well, we've just met each other a few weeks ago, but we're definitely on the same page on a lot of this stuff. We both love being spinning instructors. So I have a funny feeling we are going to continue to talk to each other regularly. Really appreciate you coming on the podcast, Recruiting Trailblazers, today, mate. And thanks for all the wisdom and stories that you've shared with us today.
Thanks for having me, man. This was a really enjoyable chat.
Cheers.